Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's conference. At this time, all lines are on a listen-only mode. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to today's host, Ms. Linda Harris. Ma'am, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. Good afternoon to everyone, and welcome to this last call in the class series on what the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act means for programs serving low-income Americans. Our discussion this afternoon will be Making the Connection, New Opportunities to Serve Older Youth with Our Recovery Efforts. And I'm happy to have a wonderful panel here. We have Mala Thakur, who's the Executive Director of the National Youth Employment Coalition, Sally Prouty, who's the Executive Director of the CORE Network, and we have Don Spangler, who's a policy advisor for the Philadelphia Youth Network. Before getting into the discussion, I want to remind everyone that we can accept questions via email. You can email to audioconference@clasp.org. That's audioconference is one word. And we will either try and intersperse the questions, or if not, we will get to them towards the end of our discussion. Just a little bit of context for this discussion. We are talking about youth, young adults, and how do we make sure that they are incorporated into the effort. Our young adults have been particularly hard hit during the economic recession. They are facing their lowest employment levels in 60 years. We're talking about teen employment rate this past summer of only 32% and just 20% for black teens, and we know that in areas of high economic distress, the issue of youth connecting to the workforce will remain a problem. The recovery package contains billions in funding, which will soon be hitting our states and communities, and there's funding for job training, for job creation. And it's going to be flowing to rebuild the infrastructure and equip workers with the skills needed to refuel a revitalized economy. So we see this as an unprecedented opportunity to reach out to our low-skilled and unskilled youth, engage them in this rebuilding process, put them into jobs, and at the same time invest in upgrading their skills so that as the economy recovers, as we have our new green industries, there will be opportunities for young people. Having youth as part of the recovery and part of the solution, not part of the problem, I think is where we're trying to, where we want to go and what this discussion is going to be about. We aren't talking about any one funding stream in the Recovery Act, because part of the opportunity is that there really are many funding streams and many opportunities to tap to support getting our young people engaged to this process. We've got the $1.2 billion in Workforce Investment Act funds that will flow through states and local communities specifically to do programming for youth. There's $50 million in Youth Build funds that will most likely go to communities that are somewhat lined up in the solicitation process. We also have to remember that there's $500 million in WIA adult funds, and when we talk about young people 16 to 24, they are a priority or should be a priority population also for the adult funds. Soon coming down the pipe will be $750 million in Department of Labor discretionary funding for high growth and emerging industry sectors, which people should be thinking about, is there a way that these funds can also leverage opportunities for our youngsters. And we've got $1 billion in the Community Development Block Grant, $1 billion in the Community Services Block Grant, $13 billion in Title I Education Act, which if directed at our secondary institutions could help with looking at multiple pathways. Combine that with the many infrastructure, community repair projects, weatherization, transportation that's going to be happening. There is going to be a lot going on. The challenge, and we're very aware of the challenge on the ground, is they're all coming through different funding streams, different agencies, very siloed, and it's moving fast. So it's going to take a great deal of advocacy on the part of those who care about this population to assure that they're not left behind. it's going to take a lot of innovation on the part of our programs on the ground to meet the demands of the challenge of being able to be stimulative, effective, quick, and responsive, and connected to areas of the economy. And it's going to take leadership on the part of those that administer these funding streams. So having all of that as a backdrop, I'm going to ask Mala Tuktur to talk with us a bit about. Mala is just returning from her national meeting with members from across the country where recovery was a subject of much discussion. And so I'm going to ask Mala, based on what you've been looking at, what you've been hearing, and what you know from your members about best practice, what should or could and what are our administrators thinking about as they look to put this funding stream out there?
Well, thank you, Linda. Yes, this was a topic of much discussion at our members' forum with over 100 organizations from across the country. And while initially much of the focus, you know, will be on summer jobs given the timing of the recovery investment, our members are also thinking about ways in which to use the summer jobs experience as a building block to year-round employment, training and education programs and opportunities, particularly for older youth. And we talked a lot around the consideration of almost a summer plus notion that would lead to longer-term engagement in employment, skill development, and potential connections to secondary and post-secondary pathways. For example, in the WIA funding stream, some of the activities that we talked about in addition to summer employment would be around developing work experiences and other activities that integrate work-based and classroom-based learning, an opportunity to focus on the neediest youth and those dropping out. Also, continued services during the non-summer months, including transition to training, reconnecting to academic opportunities, or transitional jobs models. Also, there are a lot of opportunities in the adult funding stream for older youth that could tap into and connect with occupational skills training, on-the-job training, programs that combine and leverage workplace and education instruction and really look at a blended funding streams that are supported by Department of Labor, but some of the other funding streams that you mentioned, such as education. So we talked a lot about using sort of the economic recovery funds as a building block, particularly for older out-of-school youth.
What and in that discussion, Mala, in terms of the challenges or what were some of the issues that the communities or the members that were at your forum, what were some of the things that they're anticipating that they're going to have to be able to deal with in order to make this an effective use of the funding, especially in light of there is tremendous pressure from the Department of Labor about getting summer up and getting it right.
Right. Well, the first is around income eligibility. That's going to be a major challenge that we have raised with the Department of Labor and others, and that is going to be a major stumbling block, particularly to enrolling out-of-school youth. This is something that can only be changed by law, so we foresee that as a challenge and are looking at ways in which, I mean, at the moment, you know, there's not too much you can do if you don't change the law, so that's number one. And then, you know, serving, you know, out-of-school youth, while it's a challenge, it's also an opportunity. Local areas can increase slots and service capacity of existing youth core programs or adding internships and work experiences to strong alternative ed programs that may not have work components, connecting to college preparation and bridge programs. So there is, while it's a challenge serving older out-of-school youth, particularly in the summer, I think there are ways in which local areas could connect older youth and out-of-school youth using sort of summer as a starting point. The third area also is around the capacity of youth service professionals. In a system that's been decimated over many years, it's initially a challenge, but there is an opportunity with the flow of funds through the recovery package to build and rebuild service delivery for the long term. And, you know, there is an opportunity to sort of look to the governor's 15% of discretionary funds as an opportunity to serve older out-of-school youth through which the eligibility requirements, the income eligibility requirements, do not apply.
Okay. It's one of the things, too, is that you may have mentioned it, Mala, but that there is actually the requirement that at least, it's a WIA requirement, that at least 30% of the funding must be spent on out-of-school youth. And so that really does require that local areas think about programming that's beyond just the summer and the summer program. And, Sally, I think I'm going to ask you to come in on that, because when we start talking about the out-of-school population, we are talking about a group that will need a more supported program and environment. And traditionally, transitional jobs programs and service corps programs have proven to be kind of an effective vehicle for combining employment, training, leadership development. And in the context of this push towards green and preparing for greening of the economy, what can you say about the role that CORES can play to connect to the infrastructure efforts that are going on?
Thank you, Linda. It's a pleasure to participate in the discussion. And I'll say that my assignment for this call is to, number one, describe the CORE program model, to explain its relevance to the new and emerging green economy, as Linda said, to share regarding funding streams accessible through the Recovery Act to support CORES, and also to share regarding how to approach using these funding streams. So it's not an easy task. I'll give it my best shot. Okay, so the CORE Network is a national member association, and our members are service and conservation CORES. Currently, there are 136 CORES working in 42 states plus D.C. and enrolling 26,000-plus young people annually. Since 1985, over 600,000 young people have enrolled in CORES represented by the CORE Network. So the CORE program model, CORES are state and local programs engaging primarily youth and young adults ages 16 to 25 in service to their communities. Approximately 40% of CORES are based in government agencies and 60% in nonprofit organizations. The majority of young people coming to CORES are looking for a second chance. In return for their efforts and their investment in service in their community, CORE members receive guidance by adult mentors and role models, a modest stipend, and hence truly categorized as a transitional job, and a wide range of member services, including education, life skill and leadership development, and career preparation. And all of this is occurring while they're investing in service in their communities. Service and Conservation CORES is a direct descendant of the Depression-era CCC, in which over 3 million young men dramatically improved the nation's public lands while receiving food, shelter, education, and a very precious $30 a month stipend. Today's CORES provide a wealth of conservation, infrastructure improvement, and human service projects. And there are projects that are identified by their communities as important. Some improve public lands. Others provide critical energy conservation services, including weatherization. Some restore natural habitats and create urban parks and gardens. Still others provide disaster preparation and recovery assistance. And we say often, some CORES tutor and some fight forest fires. That's a wide range. We know from random assignment evaluation that young people enrolled in CORES have substantial earnings and employment gains, that risk factors decrease, and that findings are most significant for young African-American men. CORES are not franchised models. Rather, they're organized around a common set of principles and practices and are unique to each community. In recent years, the development of a CORE to Career program model and a Civic Justice CORE program model focusing enrollment on formerly incarcerated and court-involved youth have been particularly effective. Relevance to the new and emerging green economy. The greening of communities has been a primary focus of the work of CORE since the 30s, and CORE members have been preparing for work in green jobs for all of that time. Only recently has that work been recognized as important. Funding streams available in the Recovery Act. In addition to Workforce Investment Act, we anticipate the announcement of the availability of Green Jobs Act funding, and that's purported to be at the $500 million level, and we're very interested to see, and we're hopeful that we're going to see a portion of that for engaging disconnected young people. Also, grant funding is available through the Corporation for National and Community Service, and that amount in the Stimulus Recovery Act is $89 million. The method of funding that I think is most unfamiliar to workforce programs is what we call fee for service. It's actually sponsor match or fee for service. So it's money that is in exchange for the service provided. The agencies and organizations actually provide monies based on a cooperative agreement to support the work of the CORE. And multiple federal agencies have monies that are available for this sponsor match fee-for-service category. In particular, and longtime partners with CORES are the Department of Agriculture, and the leading agency in partnership with us is the Forest Service, and they have $1.1 billion. The Department of Interior, they have a National Park Service, and they're a lead agency in terms of partnership with CORES, and they have $2.5 billion. The Department of Transportation, another lead agency, has $27 billion. Departments of Commerce, Defense, all the departments that manage public lands have monies available. And interestingly, there is wording in the statute that directs them to the maximum extent possible to work with youth-serving organizations. How these funding streams support workforce development goals, and you all know that workforce development best practices must be utilized regardless of the funding stream. And in addition, when using fee-for-service monies, it's necessary to fulfill the cooperative agreement by providing the service that's required. So if it's energy audits and weatherization, the work just must be done. At its heart, service is creative problem-solving related to community and the environment, and as such, it provides a wonderful learning place for our young people. So service learning is what we're about, and our goal is to have CORE members move from being potentially destructive in their community to being leaders and problem solvers in their communities. Thanks.
Sally, thanks a lot for that background and that information. On the fee for service, there's real potential there, but am I correct that that while you have these agencies that can do the fee-for-service, that doesn't pay for the operational costs, so that there's real opportunity to use some of the training money to support or to blend to help expand the CORE's operational ability so they can, in fact, be available for the fee-for-service? Or how would you see sort of the inner workings between the CORES and the partnerships that they could possibly have with the workforce system and some of these funding streams?
You're absolutely correct, Linda. The money for the infrastructure, that is the CORE, the central elements of the CORE, have to be paid for apart from the fee-for-service type activity. So the organization has to be in place and ready to leverage itself to attract the fee-for-service, and I see workforce development dollars, and they are in some places in this country, supporting CORES in ways that that are where the dollars are leveraged to the maximum extent.
Okay.
So it's a lot to think about, and we have great examples, and would perhaps there's an offline conversation about fee-for-service and that potential.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a real, I mean, raising this at least as a conversation to be had at the local level about how does the capacity of the Corps, the resources that may be coming through the local or the states, and the opportunities for infrastructure, how those do marry to expand opportunity, I think is a good conversation to continue at the local level and that people should be thinking about. We did have a question come in about the $750 million discretionary dollars that will be available from Department of Labor, and I should say that the guidance and how that money is going to be distributed, our presumption is going to be a discretionary process from the Department of Labor, but that has not yet been has not been released how that's going to happen, but we do know that $500,000 of those grants, million will be for activities related to the green economy, and the other $250 million would have priority in the health industry and would support, it's not just for youth activities, but certainly there's the opportunity for folks to begin to think about how these things come together to be in line for discretionary funding when those details come out. Now, we have Don Spangler, who actually, I like to say, live from the Pennsylvania discussion. He actually left the state discussion across the state about how recovery should be happening to participate in this conversation. And we specifically wanted Don's how you can approach this beyond just an individual community, but what's the role of state and what's the role of sort of the broader leadership to move a youth agenda. So, Don, thanks for stepping out of the meeting, and tell us a bit about how you all are approaching it there.
Absolutely. I mean, the timing really is terrific for the call, because I'm literally sitting here, one wall removed from about 100 people who've come at the invitation of the State WIB and Youth Council to hear about a number of issues relating to Recovery Act youth components. Let me just give you a little bit of background. I mean, our State Youth Council has focused on two specific priorities, one being enhancing work-based learning opportunities for young people, and number two, out-of-school youth recovery. So given the alignment of the council's priorities with the goals of the Recovery Act, the decision was made basically to take an existing meeting and turn it into a day-long interactive session, not only for the council members, but for local WIB directors and staff and youth council staff and departments of education and labor, frankly, just so everybody could get on the same page and hear the same message about state expectations. And I guess there's not a lot that the state can insist that locals do around these programs, but there's certainly a lot of bully pulpit potential, and I'm really pleased to report that a lot of that is happening here. In particular, there's a very positive message being put out about, we can do this, we must do this, we will do this, we'll do it together, we'll do it well. Talking about the importance of getting out in front of the issues and talking about media messaging, about the value of these dollars and how important they're going to be for youth all across Pennsylvania. The Labor Department the State Labor Department is also very strongly promoting, not just summer jobs, but enriched academic components and college exposure opportunities. And in addition to that, as we mentioned, and most particularly for this call, really calling on locals to do a particularly strong push on innovative approaches around this older out-of-school youth population, 18 to 24. And in fact, I didn't hear this as a commitment, but I certainly heard it as a point of strong consideration that the department was going to look at their 15% leadership funds to try to figure out ways to encourage local model development and roll out, particularly for these older out-of-school youth. So that was very encouraging. There's also a good bit of discussion going on about cross-system collaboration, not just the Labor Department. I mean, it's pretty easy to see in that these things are rolling out so fast and the push is to get the money spent that the default is often going to be, okay, we just have to stay within the lines and we're going to do what we need to do and get it done. But happily, there's also a lot of push on trying to look outside of our own little bureaucratic barriers and silos. The Department of Education is very good about that, and they're here participating. Also, though, at the local level, there are a lot of folks who are trying to look very holistically at the way these funds are coming into local communities. And Philly, the governor's Office of Sustainability, has that charge. But we also heard from the city of Lancaster, Lehigh Valley, and a few other places where they're actually taking a very strong cross geography, cross sector approach to trying to see how all these funds can be blended together, and in particular how we might be able to see these for opportunities for our older out of school youth. And then this is not an issue that's relevant to us in Pennsylvania, but I think it's also important for the listeners to know that, you know, as many of you probably do, that the Department of Labor for a number of years has been pursuing a shared youth vision, and in fact fairly recently has begun to fund the shared youth vision partnership with a number of states that really tries to get at that cross-system collaboration, particularly in support of our highest risk youth. And again, Pennsylvania is not a part of that, but those of you who are in states that are a part of that partnership, I think probably have something to build on in terms of suggesting or advocating that this more holistic view take place in terms of how these dollars are being spent. So we're very encouraged, frankly, by what we're hearing from the state. I think they are putting forth the sort of leadership role that you'd expect and hope, and we'll see where we go from here.
Oh, thanks, Don. Just for the listeners, there is a link on the resource page to the Shared Youth Vision report, and I believe there are 28 states, and they do have the 28 states in there. So you can find out if you're in a vision state, and that's also important because at least at the session last week, there was talk about the Department of Labor actually trying to use the vehicle of the shared youth states to encourage them to be innovative and creative. So that's you know, one way to get more innovative use of the 15%. Don, you had asked some questions, I know, before about the education connections. You know, what's going on? What have you found out and about how to leverage any of the education resources in recovery?
Right. Well, fortunately, we've got, I think, good relationships between agencies, both at the state level and also in Philadelphia, where I do most of my work. But here today, we have, for example, the policy director from the Department of Education and the director of the Adult Basic Education Office. Both of them have said all the right words, and I think there is meaning behind them. In fact, the Department of Education just last fall hosted an America's Promise Alliance Dropout Prevention and Reengagement Summit, so I think they really do have a pretty keen sense of the importance of the whole recovery strategies. I guess what we understand is that while the State Department of Education can't tell local school districts who are actually getting the great bulk of this $13 billion in Title I, can't really tell them what to do. Certainly, you can encourage the use of the money, I guess, as the Recovery Act itself does. You know, 40% of the money for middle and high schools, students in the Title I eligible kids in those schools, as well as certainly you may spend those funds on recovery and prevention strategies as well. So that is certainly a leadership role that the State Department of Education can play, and I believe ours is going to be prepared to do that. I mean, in addition, I think we are looking to try to work with the Department of Education as they put together their proposal for competitive incentive grant funds, which are actually going to be issued. We believe they're going to be two procurements, one in the fall and one in the following spring, that states will apply directly to the Department of Education for fairly significant funding to promote various aspects of innovative reform. So what we're going to be suggesting to our colleagues at the state is that we really ought to be looking at ensuring that, recovery strategies are part of that mix. You know, we're certainly not going to argue that it should be the only thing, but it certainly should be part of that mix, number one, because it's the right thing to do, but number two, because it feels to us as if that's going to make your application more competitive. So yeah, I think there's real potential at the state level. And just real quickly, at the local level, you know, we have our Project U-Turn citywide campaign about dropout prevention and reengagement, and our school district is a very strong partner in that strategy. We've actually used our regular WIA allocation to support some wraparound services and bridge literacy programs for young people returning both from delinquent placement and just from and returning from out of school status to in school status. And our school district strategic plan that was just issued has a significant component on recovery, and it appears that at least there's going to be a strong attempt to use some of our local Title I money to support young people who are in what we call accelerated high schools, which are small high schools for overage and undercredited young people to help them get back on the graduation track. So, as I said, it's sort of good news, at least tentatively good news, both at the state and local level on the use of these education funds. And so I would certainly encourage the listeners to try to make those sorts of approaches, because I suspect that they would be favorably received.
Okay. One part of the, you know, in the DOL guidance on the Workforce Investment Act recovery funds, they actually do emphasize services that support older out-of-school youth transitioning to training, but also reconnecting to academic opportunities via multiple pathways. That would also include, and would be a good time to look at, how these funds can be used to help youngsters who are in some of the alternative programs actually bridge to post-secondary education, both having a job and having the support that they would need to be successful in post-secondary.
I agree completely. I mean, it's really heartening, frankly, to see the emphasis in the guidance on multiple pathways and education pathways. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Okay. Let me also say, oftentimes, I think I sort of mentioned it, but I want to come back to, we talk about youth, especially when we talk about the workforce, and we think about the youth programs and the youth funding stream. But when we talk about a age span that is 18 to 24 years old, this is a priority population for the adult funding stream also, or it should be a priority population. And then resources coming into the one-stop system through recovery to deal with the issues of connecting disconnected populations. You want to talk a bit about, Mala, your thoughts about how the one-stop in the adult funding stream can also come into play to affect the pathways for these out-of-school youth?
Yeah, I think that you know there are a lot of opportunities, particularly for the older youth, with the adult funding stream, particularly around a couple of areas. You know, training services that focus on occupational skills training, on-the-job training, and some programs that combine, you know, workplace training and related instruction. I mean, there are a lot of training programs and opportunities supported by the adult funding stream that many older youth and young adults can tap into, as well as adult basic education training to focus on English as a second language or work on the GED. So there's some areas there around training that I think older youth can tap into in the adult funding stream. Also, I think there's funds that could be accessed for supportive services that many young people who will be accessing these services that they will need that relate to childcare, transportation, housing, and other types of supportive services. So I think that there are a lot of opportunities with the adult funding stream. But again, I think at the local level in particular, you just need to be aware that young people in the 18 to 24 age range are eligible, and to think about coupling, you know, these funds with the youth activities funding.
Sally, Don, do you have any thoughts about the one-stop and adult funding streams and how this can sort of leverage change in those systems?
I can give it some thought. Through our regular WEA program, we do, of course, offer some occupational skills training focused on older out-of-school youth up to 21, of course, not to 24. With some local unions in terms of healthcare, in terms of information technology, in terms of a number of high-priority occupations. And we're fortunate to have five community-based youth centers, which are, in fact, the successors to the old three youth opportunity centers that we had. So we've got some experience on dealing with older youth that are out of school and needing occupational training. But frankly, we have not worked very successfully as yet with our one-stop system, and we're really looking forward to try to figure out what the best strategies along these lines might be. I mean, for example, and I think Mala and others alluded to this earlier, I mean, you can certainly envision a situation in which we bring young people, older out-of-school youth, into service, into a job work experience during the summer, continue that through some period of time in a year-round program, but then want to co-enroll or move them out from the youth program sort of seamlessly into an adult-funded program, because obviously that's where they're going to get the higher level skills and employer connections. So we don't know precisely what that's going to look like, but we're hoping we're going to get some support from our state leaders here to help us develop some models and figure that out.
And Sally, you have any thoughts on that?
Linda, I would say, and sort of mirror what Don is saying, in that there are areas around the country where our cores are working very successfully with one-stops, and areas where, quite frankly, it hasn't worked to this point. But as I listen to Don thinking about the discussions at the state level today, it would be wonderful if that translates to the local level and to one-stop systems, and in thinking about the revenue streams that they have, and how do they maximize opportunities, then it always, for me, goes back to it really is about individual plans for each of the young people enrolled in our programs wherever they are, and how can they best be served, and what are the services that they need, and then planning the monies to be directed towards supporting those services. So that's not any surprise to anybody, but it just seems to me that translating that state level to the local level thinking would be a great thing.
Okay, I think it's also...
I'm sorry.
Mala, go on. This is Mala again.
I think another point to think about is, as we think sort of beyond summer and opportunities, particularly for older youth and young adults, you know, there could be an instrumental role that the one-stop, you know, could have the potential to play. It might be something that comes up later for folks in the local and state areas, but I think that there's some potential there as you... see the recovery funds as a building block.
Well, I also think when we talk about opportunity is that the workforce system has been relatively underfunded, especially on the side as it related to being able to provide training. So a good part of the infusion coming into the system is going to actually be allowing the one-stops to think differently about how they provide training. And it's interesting in the Teagle that came from the Department of Labor that they are encouraging the use of several training vehicles. That's not just the same individual training accounts, customized training, OJT, contracts with higher education institutions, apprenticeships, and even customized contracts with community-based organizations, which is a much broader span of training vehicles than has been up until now used in the workforce system. And so I think it provides a lot of opportunity to look at ways to use the training dollars to align with the state and regional economic recovery plans. But at the same time, it's an opportunity to say, and how do you fit into that? So I think that, you know, I know the devil is in how you're going to, you know, the details and performance standards, but we do, in fact, have an opportunity here.
Linda, I was also thinking about the provisions and the guidance. It's such a strong focus also on the nexus with community colleges. And I think that's going to be another piece that we're going to try to parlay into something. Our Community College of Philadelphia in particular has been a great partner for us, and we're already doing a good bit of work with them. But seeing that additional incentive or encouragement within the guidance to work with the community college system, I think gives us even more reason to go farther with that.
Yeah, and John, that's actually a good segue into sort of the next question, and that is, you know, we've got this infusion into the workforce system and into communities and states to do something different in the way we train and what we do about youth. To what extent will the way the workforce programs recovery, the way the workforce system expends these recovery dollars and the way communities expend these recovery dollars to connect youth, what impact is that going to have on the discussions about reauthorization of the Workforce Act and other legislative initiatives for youth? Is this a time to really try some innovation and plant some seeds? And so what do you think about the future? What are we going to be saying 6 months from now, a year from now? Mala?
You know, I think that there are going to be some direct implications. I think we can learn a lot from the recovery funds and how they're spent as we think about reauthorization, not just of Workforce Investment Act, but No Child Left Behind and, you know, any potential new legislation. I think some of the challenges that we talked about earlier on this call with respect to eligibility, serving out-of-school youth and older youth, and you know, some of the issues that many folks are facing around performance standards, in a way you have an opportunity to sort of plant the seeds and test some of these areas out through the recovery package implementation. So I think that, you know, it could be a real opportunity to sort of test some of these ideas out, test out the innovation, to think about a longer-term strategy to reconnect and include low-income youth into the emerging workforce, and also connect with, you know, a lot of the cross-system collaboration that Don and others mentioned, not only with the workforce system, but for other systems. I also think there's an opportunity to look at how we tap into multiple funding streams to support employment, secondary, post-secondary pathways. I think that there's an opportunity to inform sort of systemically some of the reauthorizations that are coming up. And there's also an opportunity to think about how we want to build and continue to build the capacity of youth service, youth delivery systems that have been ignored for a long time. But with the infusion of funds across systems through the Recovery Act, I mean, I think that there we can take what we do in the next, you know, 18 months or so and inform and maybe redesign or improve the design of service delivery.
Sally, do you want to comment on the legislative landscape and how we actually use what happens during this process, how that's going to impact on those discussions?
Well, I think building on Mala's comments, we're encouraging programs that we're working with around the country to consider the Recovery Act funding from, again, multiple streams if possible, as the opportunity for demonstrating effectiveness and to, when we're thinking all the time about what would it mean to take our programs to scale, and that's the programs represented throughout the folks who are on this call. So how do we begin to attract resources and systematically expand opportunity for young people? And I think this is an amazing opportunity for us. We all know that whatever we do, we have to do it really well, but demonstrating effectiveness and particularly rapid gear up and effectively serving substantially larger numbers of young people.
Okay, and Don?
Well, ditto to all, but I just want to come back and once again hit the cross-system piece. I'm hopeful we can do this well in Philly and in Pennsylvania and across the country. It just feels as if we can get that piece right, that it will open up so many more possibilities for these young people. Since we all know how devalued and underfunded this piece has been, but if in fact we can make some progress and work with education partners as well as partners in health and human services and in other places, it feels as if there really could be an important opportunity just to enlarge the table of people that can come together around building effective services for these young people. Beyond that, I think we've alluded to this as well. If the reauthorization ratifies the extension of the age range up to 24, it does feel as if we're probably going to need to figure out some more structured and rational intersection between the youth and the adult systems. I mean, that's such a big overlap to sort of leave it out there, you know, you can go either way with it. You know, if it's 18 to 21, you know, it's something where you can say, well, all right, you know, sort of locally, you sort of figure it out. 18 to 24, that's a big range. And so I would like to think again, if we can figure out some effective models through this period of time, that maybe we could actually help to structure some of those reauthorization conversations as we extend the age range up.
Yeah. You know, Don, that's a good point that you just made. And actually, Mal, I might ask you to comment on that. And that is the age group 14 to 24 is a huge range. And we have a funding stream coming in, or funding streams coming in. What advice would you give to areas that are trying to both manage, you know, to think about how do you program for a range that goes from 14 to 24, and what are some of the ways to assure that we're actually having impact in the way we do programming for the younger in school, but not leaving behind those who are out of school and out of work, especially as choices and priorities have to be made. Mala, do you have any sense of how some of the communities are approaching that?
Well, I think some of the communities that in our membership are sort of thinking about the summer piece more for younger youth and trying to potentially engage older youth in the summer, but with an eye toward sort of a longer-term connection to education and work, and either through also GED types of programs coupled with work or connections to post-secondary experiences. I think that's where some of our members are focusing. A lot of our members also work with in-school youth, where, you know, there is a strong connection between education systems, work experiences that are targeting the younger population, because as you just said, you know, that 10-year range is quite a range, so the programming has to be a little different. And I think on the older youth side, connecting to some of the adult streams and the one-stops is one way in which, you know, some of our members are looking. And then others are looking at the traditional secondary school systems, as well as some of the alternative learning environments, particularly for those who are working to help support their families. So those are some of the ideas that have bubbled up.
And Sally, the programs that have the intensity of the cores and to sustain, you know, to have those grow, you know, and sustain and, you know, in a community, what should places be thinking about, not just as it relates to recovery, but a big part of the question that comes up has to do with how do you sustain? There's this infusion coming in. But, you know, can you ratchet up without any guarantee that there are going to be new resources coming in? So how should communities be thinking about, you know, about that issue?
Well, thanks, Linda. We do have core programs that have been sustained over time, and there's not a home in the federal government for CORES, so, and we're working on that, but that has forced CORES to be sustainable. So we have funds at the state level, so it's state and local government funding, and there are fee-for-service funding, there's private sector funding, and we actually have a pie chart that gives the sort of historical pattern of a diverse funding base for CORES, and be happy to share that with anyone who's interested. So we encourage programs, particularly new programs that are starting up, to plan with that diverse funding in mind as opposed to being reliant on any one funding stream. And it requires multiple partners. It requires certainly federal, state, and local support, but the entity which houses the core then becomes the responsible party in bringing those representatives and funding streams together. And so hopefully new work that is stimulated by recovery package will have from the beginning sustainability in mind and be planning for what happens 6 months out, 12 months out, 18 months out, so that the work might be sustained.
Don, can I ask, and I don't know what the answer to this is, but you all are having the discussion sort of at the state level, and maybe you can take this back into your state meeting. You know, there are going to be all of these jobs that are going to happen as a result of the infrastructure projects, the transportation projects. There's going to be a requirement that there's transparency on listing them. How are states and locals thinking about assuring or what the mechanism will be to connect individuals in these programs that we're talking about to those jobs that are going to come available and be listed? Or what's your thoughts on that?
Well, it's going to be a fascinating process to watch, and not just watch, to try to get engaged in on behalf of the kids that we're talking about. I mean, one of the WIB director from the Lehigh Valley was basically talking that they had just had a meeting yesterday, and this was a citywide, Allentown, I guess, was a citywide meeting in terms of, you know, looking at all the money that was coming in and in terms of infrastructure, and she basically said, okay, I want a cut of that money for the kids we're talking about. And it's easy to say and more difficult to do when, of course, you look at the potential requirements and the pathways and the whatever you would need to actually get young people in those jobs. But at some level, I think it is, trying to get into those conversations early on and try to earmark appropriately some of these opportunities for the young people that we're talking about. I mean, it does, of course, get dicey because, often we get in situations where, we're pitting groups of people that need support against one another. So we can't. It's not a matter of like, okay, the dislocated workers against the young out of school youth or whatnot. I mean, those are clearly issues that we need. We need to employ as many people as we possibly can, and how those pieces are going to play out, it's just not clear yet to me. But I do think it is absolutely fair, as these conversations are taking place in communities and at the state level, to raise your hand and say, we need to think about at least, if not setting aside specific percentages or numbers of jobs, at least having these young people as part of that conversation. I mean, it seems to me that's the least we can do.
Okay. What are the things, and that really, Don, does point to, I guess, where I started out with the conversation, had to do with it's not going to happen automatically, that there's a need for tremendous continued advocacy. And part of advocacy is kind of knowing where the funding is coming, who it's coming in through, and what the potential uses are of those funds. So in the chart that's on the resource list, there's a beginning attempt at identifying those funding streams, the process by which the funds are going to flow, and some links to at least what the state allocations are, who the state contacts are, how the money's going to flow. And that's important information for individuals in communities to know so that they can know how to leverage these different funding streams. I think it's going to take the collective energy both on the ground at the states and federally to keep in front of the process, you know, the expectation that this is an inclusive recovery. And inclusive also includes our young people. And I think it sends a very important message if while we're trying to revitalize and rebuild the economy, we are also revitalizing and rebuilding the pathways for some of the individuals who have traditionally been outside of these efforts so that we're making an investment in the future and their position in a restored economy. So I think this conversation has at least been intended to provide or stimulate the thinking about the broader question of how we make sure youth are engaged and can be carried along with all these other efforts. I really do appreciate Don, Mala, Sally, your time on the call. This is just the beginning of the kinds of conversations that will have to be ongoing. To the listening audience, if there are other questions, I did mention several times the guidance from the Department of Labor. We will be placing the link to that Teagle on our resource list for those of you who are interested, because it is a very good document that actually also indicates the direction and the emphasis that the Department of Labor wants to see with this money. And,
Linda, I'm sorry, uh-huh. This is Mala. I just wanted to mention that we're also sort of keeping track of questions, you know, from our membership with regard to the Teagle. So we'd be happy to share some of that with folks that are on this call and beyond.
Yes, we will. It's going to be important that this works and works well for the populations we really want to see be connected. And so I thank you for your time. The audio conference will be available on our website shortly, and it's www.clasp.org. And so thanks to the panelists, and thanks to the audience for your participation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.